My wife, Mary, left on a pilgrimage to India yesterday. When I made a similar trip in 2007 to visit the sacred sites in the life of the historical Buddha, she was not interested in joining me. Mary will tell you that it was never her intention to visit India. It was not on her bucket list, even as an adventure travel destination, much less a Buddhist pilgrimage. What caused this change? She had listened to the stories, looked at the photos, and talked to the other pilgrims without ever saying, "I want to do that." After she retired in 2011, she began to come more often to Thursday nights at Sacramento Insight Meditation, or SIM, to meditate and listen to Dharma talks. After I retired last year, she began to join me more often in the mornings for daily meditation. She still does not consider herself a Buddhist. Yet, when the opportunity arose and Dennis Warren of SIM announced he was leading a second pilgrimage to India, Mary was one of the first to sign up. This decision was the effect resulting from some unfathomable combination of causes, conditions, and subtle intentions. It is this link between intentions, causes, and effects that I would like to explore with you this morning. Let's look at an example from climate science. Writer Alan Marshall tells us, "Most principles of physics are beyond question because both cause and effect are well understood. A relationship between cause and effect is proved by repeatable experiments. This is the essence of the scientific method and the source of knowledge on which we have built our technological civilization. For example, we know it takes a lot of time to heat up water. Think of waiting for water to boil on your stove before you add the pasta. We also know that most of the planet consists of oceans. Scientists call this combination of factors the thermal inertia of oceans. We are finally waking up to the fact, assuming that we don't have some political agenda that prevents us from waking up to this fact, that increased greenhouse gas emissions have resulted in increased temperatures of both the atmosphere and the oceans. As a result of all these seemingly unrelated scientific facts coming together, there is a delayed response known as climate lag between cause, increased greenhouse gas emissions, and effect, increased temperatures. Environmental scientist Dana Nucitelli, who spoke here on climate change in September, told me, "Right now, we're committed to about another half degree Celsius global surface warming based on the greenhouse gases we've emitted so far." Furthermore, scientists tell us that this will occur even if CO2 was stabilized at its current level. As Alan Marshall says, with 40 years between cause and effect, it means that average temperatures of the last decade are a result of what we were thoughtlessly putting into the air in the 1960s. Thoughtlessly is a key word here. It reveals our intentions. They were clearly not conscious, but they have led inevitably to unexpected causes and unwanted effects. Now let's bring this one home to our individual lives. An old cliche has it, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. That's the source of my title today, the road to where? Is that possible? Is it even possible for the road to hell to be paved with good intentions? In the UU tradition of honoring your free and responsible search for truth and meaning, I am not going to try to define what hell means here. For you, it may be a long time in a very hot place, an uncomfortable feeling in the pit of your stomach, or an hour listening to talk radio. But let's look at these supposedly good intentions. The first question we might ask ourselves is, are they really good? In my experience, looking closely at intentions reveals that on the surface is often an intention that reinforces our view of who we think we are. I'll give some of my spare change to this person because I am a generous person. I will tolerate that loud music on the light rail train because I am very open-minded. If we stay with the experience of the present moment, something deeper may emerge. This person makes me uncomfortable. I wonder if they will use that money for drugs. Or maybe, when are they going to turn that music off? The words really offend me, and besides, it's against the rules to be playing it on light rail. In other words, it is not unusual for our thoughts, words, and actions to be driven by mixed intentions. Notice that these intentions are based around the concept of I, me, and mine. They depend on how others view us or how we think others will view us in the context of some external moral code of right and wrong. What if we shift our focus from this self-based, externally imposed idea of good to a simpler idea? Will this intention and the thoughts, words, and actions that follow it cause harm or prevent it? Will my thoughts, words, and actions lead to arguments, dissatisfaction, and discontent? In other words, some version of hell? Or will they lead to harmony, satisfaction, and contentedness? In other words, peace. Learning the difference through direct experience of the consequences of our actions is one key to lasting happiness. Looking back at the supposedly good intentions that supposedly pave the road to hell, we can legitimately ask, are they really intentions? Or are they just wishful thinking? How about self-deception? Intention precedes every action. Scratching an itch, voicing an opinion, even thinking a thought. As in the examples above, the intention can be subtle. So we may set an intention to watch our diet more closely. But when faced with a lunch menu featuring cherry pie a la mode, that intention may just fade away under a barrage of competing rationale. I've been working so hard, I deserve this. I walked 2 miles this morning, so it's no big deal. I'll eat less for dinner tonight. The intention is not strong enough on its own to stand up to long-standing thought patterns and habits. Chances are that intention to eat less for dinner tonight won't survive either. Now that we're about halfway through the talk, let me reveal a secret. When Roger asked me several months ago to preach on this day, I presented him with several subjects I had been pondering and exploring. The topic we agreed on for this sermon was karma. I had just finished teaching a 4-week class on the subject, giving a talk at SIM's Thursday night meeting back in March, and writing an article for the SIM newsletter on the topic. But I was concerned that because pop culture has developed such a skewed idea of karma, you might come in with too strong a filter to allow you to hear what I presented, or you might not come at all. After all, we know the bumper stickers. My karma ran over your dogma. I hope karma slaps you in the face before I do. Dear karma, I have a list of a few people you missed. Then there's the Dilbert cartoon. Dogbert, the evil HR director, tells Dilbert, I believe in karma. That means I can do bad things to people all day long, and I assume they deserve it. Not a very uplifting subject. So, where did our pop culture get this skewed idea of karma? Inaccurate. Karma in pre-Buddhist India was mechanistic. David Loy, a Zen teacher, wrote an introduction to an article in Buddha Dharma magazine a year ago that was entitled Karma, Fate, or Freedom. And he mentioned that performing a Vedic ceremony, the ambient religion that was around at the time of the Buddha, about, what would that be, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, performing a Vedic ceremony correctly would sooner or later lead to the desired consequences. So there was this idea that the rituals had to be formed in exactly a certain way, or the result, the karma, would not come about. There was also an element common in the culture at that time about reincarnation tied with karma, that actions in this present life generate good or bad karma, resulting in being born in a favorable or unfavorable realm in the next life. These ideas influence the view we have of karma as either fate or retribution. However, the historical Buddha focused on karma as volitions or motivations, intention. This is illustrated in the first two verses of perhaps the best-known Buddhist text, the Dhammapada. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. As David Loy says, what we intentionally do is what makes us what we are. In other words, we create our habits and live with the consequences. So in that sense, karma creates us and not the other way around. This is not done in a mechanistic way driven by fate. All of our actions are like watering seeds. If we pay attention to our intentions and learn to feel the results of our actions, we can even choose which seeds to water. This element of choice is what takes karma out of the realm of fate and into the realm of freedom. So the Buddhist view of karma is neither fate nor retribution. In a sense, the roads to everywhere in our lives are paved with our deepest intentions. So we might want to pay a bit more attention to how we speak, act, and maybe even think. There is even a separate word for the results that come from the intentional actions. The intentional actions are karma, and that's vipaka, which means fruit. So in the current moment, we act in a certain way with a certain momentum of intention behind it, and eventually some fruit will result from that. Now, trying to figure out what that is, it's one of the, what the Buddha called the imponderables. It's one of those things that if you try to figure out in this moment what multiple causes and conditions resulted in the current moment, it will unhinge the mind, he said. So the purpose of this is not to try to figure these things out analytically, it's to actually look at our behavior and try to alter it in a positive direction. Another analogy often used for this pattern is that our habits are like a wheel repeatedly falling into the same rut. As we repeat an unhealthy habit over and over again, it becomes harder to act in a new way. This momentum of behavior is karma at work. Each action influences the next moment. Each repetition performed on autopilot conditions the next action we are likely to take the next time similar circumstances arise. However, there is another way, as illustrated in a poem by Portia Nelson entitled Autobiography in Five Chapters. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. How would we find another street in real life? If my habitual reaction to being criticized is to launch a defensive counterattack, not that that's my pattern, but you know, I'm just using this as an illustration. I might start by learning to be aware of how it feels inside when I am criticized. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? What happens in my breath and in my body when I hear criticism? Perhaps my breath becomes rapid and shallow, and a flush of warmth comes to my face, and a tightness grips my chest. Is that okay? Can I tolerate rapid breathing and a warm face and tight chest? If so, bringing awareness to this felt sense of our direct experience allows us to take a pause before speaking and acting in ways we might later regret. If not, keep practicing. Once we become familiar with our patterns of reactivity, we can develop the ability to notice the sensations in the body and breath at an earlier point in the interaction, allowing us even more space to respond consciously with awareness and kindness rather than reacting from old habits. This is the first step to turning the corner to the next street. Just stepping back a moment to put down a quick note about the past and future life aspect of karma. Most modern teachers of Buddhism focus on the present life consequences of our actions. There's no need to believe in past or future lives to understand that effects can act over time, as in the climate change example. Another example is to think of the light from a distant galaxy. We see the galaxy. Our mind tells us that we are seeing the galaxy in the moment. But it could have died centuries ago, because that light takes millions of years to get here, right? If we act as if this life is all we have, what harm would it do if our future lives turned out to exist? Wouldn't the choices we make to be happy in this life also make us happy in that hypothetical future life? So we win either way. Many Buddhists remind themselves of what's important each day with 5 recollections. By reflecting on old age, sickness, and death, the events of the day are put in perspective. These are the same 3 reflections that move the historical Buddha to set out on his spiritual journey and eventually find a way to freedom. The last 2 reflections remind us of impermanence and of karma. All that I hold dear, beloved, and pleasing will someday change and vanish. I accept this loss. All that I have are my actions. I am the owner of my actions and the heir of my actions. Whether good or evil, I accept this karma. I recommend this practice to you. Many versions of these 5 recollections or remembrances are available on that other repository of Buddhist wisdom, the internet. Search for 5 recollections, and as of a couple days ago, you'll get 6.8 million results. It's probably over 7 million by now. Find one that resonates with you, and then develop your own wording. Moving back out from the personal application of karma to a wider view, scholar Andrew Olensky tells us, contemporary Buddhism is facing the global challenge of dealing with the past karma of our species. Indeed, all species on Earth are facing the global challenge created by the ripples from humanity's past actions. So just as we can use a deeper understanding of karma to transform our own lives and change our habitual patterns, we can use an understanding of karma to engage this world with responsible action. The inaccurate view of karma tells us, that's just the way it is. It's fate. There's nothing I can do about it. The view of karma I'm describing this morning tells us, my actions matter. I may not understand every effect they cause, but I am responsible for making choices to heal the earth. May your choices bring you happiness, and may your thoughts, words, and actions bring healing to an earth that needs our compassion and wisdom so much. So may it be.